acted without real, shall we say, government sponsorship. Later, other settlements were built, set up, organized. But it's really not until 1878, I believe, that the British government warned the government in Buenos Aires that it would stop emigration to Argentina unless the government took serious measures to stopping the cattle rustling by the native settlements. What were they? The Indians from southern Buenos Aires who raided one very, very famous colony is the English colony on the Sauce Grande River that produced two wonderful characters in English fiction, who are the Facon Grande and Facon Chico, Big Knife and Little Knife, and they are cousins Walker and Edwards near Bahia Blanca. But it's only then that the British government, after receiving the complaints of consuls, land agents, and that sort of thing, that they say, all right, clean up the house or we stop migration. It is thought, although there's no document, it is thought, fairly well thought out, that it's complaints such as that one of the British government, the German government, the Swiss government and the French government, among possibly other smaller nations, in European nations, that precipitate what we call the Conquista del Desierto, the conquest of the desert, led by General Roca against the native Indian in 1880.
Before 1825, for the Foreign Office, what was the official status of the Rio de la Plata provinces? The official status.
The official status of the River Plate provinces was that of territories of Spain fighting for their independence. There is some confusion here because obviously Westminster was encouraging independence. Since the very beginning, since always, should we say. But at the same time, the British establishment, the political establishment at Westminster, did not want to have any link or relationship with revolutionaries, in quotes that word, dangerous revolutionaries. And at the same time, Spain, except for the time of the Napoleonic occupation, but Spain was a European monarchy. So a monarchy in the United Kingdom or Great Britain or whatever you want to call it did not want to be seen in its own political community as going against another monarchy in Europe. So there is that arrangement. Britain always wanted the commerce with the River Plate, but wanted to do it with Spanish permission. Spain did not grant that permission, so the only way was to encourage independence, but you couldn't associate with revolutionaries. So you have a roly-poly situation which doesn't really reach any termination until Canning really pushes hard for the recognition of the former colony.
Let us move on now to history. There is a very interesting chapter in the book you wrote, which, by the way, let me congratulate you for it, because it is really, really good, very interesting, about the period between the Revolution of May and the official recognition of Argentina as an independent country by the United Kingdom, in which there was a character, Mr. Staples, who wanted to be the consul of Argentina, but he never got the official appointment.
Let's be frank. I mean, anywhere in the world where there is an English-speaking or British community of any size, you're bound to have a substantial percentage of eccentrics. And this man, Staples, Robert Ponsonby Staples, was a merchant dealing in salted beef and hides. But he also really took upon himself to be the representative of the community. The community had different people. There was a rather irascible Scot before 1810, Staples takes over sort of at the time of the independentist movements of San Martin, the efforts of Pueyrredón in Buenos Aires, eventually Rivadavia in Buenos Aires, all leaders of government. And the interesting thing is that the government of Buenos Aires recognized him as a representative, whereas the British government did not. They gave him letters at one point.
What's the difference, the actual difference between having letters and being an official representative?
In the case of Staples, because it is a specific case, he was given a letter as an agent by somebody in the Foreign Office. The government in Buenos Aires, led by Rivadavia, rejected that letter as not recognizing the government of Buenos Aires as an independent body leading an independent nation. So Staples tried to get the Foreign Office to renew that letter, and the Foreign Office said no. But the thing is that he had in his hand a letter. It doesn't matter if it was an unimportant letter or a rejected letter. It was a letter. So therefore, he made that a stand. And eventually,
his diplomatic credential was a rejected letter.
Yes, indeed. But what did happen is that for a time, the government in Buenos Aires had no other interlocutor to address and to communicate it with London. And the British community, the merchant community, which was growing very considerably at the, 1814, 1816, 1820, it was growing as a very strong merchant community. They also needed a spokesman. And so Staples, who very much wanted to be that, was accepted as such. And so British authorities had to speak to him ex officio, simply because the merchant said, "We're not speaking to you. You speak to Staples and he can tell us what's happening." And so this rather...
more of a pragmatic thing.
A pragmatic arrangement until the famous Treaty of Friendship, Commerce, Navigation, etc., was signed in the middle of the 1820s.
And that's when Woodbine Parish...
That is when Woodbine Parish comes to Argentina after 1825. And, well, for Argentina, his name has obviously passed into history as the first British representative. But he is also the author of a tremendous book of observation in which he looks at everything from archaeology, forestry, land, farming, politics, everything. So it's a huge compendium on the River Plate published. It was published quite a lot later. It was after the 1830s. So it becomes an authoritative book when it's already old, in fact.
Finally, let us
nevertheless, he is remembered more for that. And because
of
his son,
British Railways,
Frank,
in Argentina,
was one of the directors of the railways.
That's a key factor
after 1860.
In this story.
But that history is immense, and it probably has. There's such a vast bibliography of that.
But it just some facts and figures. What, for example, what was the largest company?
What was the largest company? The Central Argentine Railway became the largest simply because
It which began, is the present day Mitre line.
It's absorbing smaller companies or merging with smaller companies, which, for instance, Central Argentina was part of the Central Córdoba, and then it was part of the Tucumán Córdoba, but also even later than that, 1880s, it builds all the branch lines in Entre Ríos, which really don't exist nowadays. They've all vanished. And I mean, this is particularly information that is dear to me because it was my great-grandfather who arrived as a draftsman and designed the lines, you know, out of Buenos Aires into the interior, and eventually took over or was in charge of building the whole Ferrocarril Entrerriano in Entre Ríos. But it is a story that begins in 1863 and just grows and grows and grows from then, especially as Argentine agriculture booms and transport was needed, more and more transport. And it was a railway transported country. In the second half of the 20th century, it became a transport nation. But at that time, nobody thought of moving by road. You moved by rail, and you moved all your goods and products that way. So it was a huge interest. You must think of all the cattle it transported to the ports, to the docks, to the meatpacking companies, and it really became by far the largest railway network in the whole of Latin America, and one of the biggest networks in the world.
In comparison to other railway networks developed by the British around the world, how Argentina's one comes?
Well, in India, would if we take the British-built railways, India would be far ahead because a bigger country, and the railways developed far more. One couldn't really compare it with the United States because the United States today has lost many of its railways. But if you take the distance from Atlantic to Pacific of the U.S. railways, you have something in mileage, in kilometers, I don't know. But it just was one of the most – Argentina's was – by virtue of it, of the, its track display and lay, it was one of the most complex networks in the world.
I mean, I'm not an engineer, but in the Pampas, the flat land
easy. But you had, although we always speak of Buenos Aires being the center of a wheel, and all the tracks were spokes that led out to the rim of that wheel, you also had a huge number of connections happening between different provincial destinations. That's why I mentioned Entre Ríos, because you have several great big yards which were terminals for four different train lines. Buenos Aires province is crisscrossed with tracks that right down to Bahía Blanca. It's true that the train only went from Bahía Blanca to Zapala in Neuquén province in northern Patagonia. In the second government of General Roca, that means 1901, 1902, it only reaches then. But for instance, the railway that runs or did run through the Andes, connecting Argentina and Chile, must be seen as something for its time, right? Which is also 1902, and it is as big as the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal. It is
a huge engineering work.
It has to be compared on that
now,
level.
There is a special chapter you dedicate in your book to the Irish community, and it is interesting the fact that Argentines, from accounts we know, they call all English-speaking people, ingleses, English. And sometimes even the non-English speaking people like the Germans or the French, they would call them Ingleses as well. But there are differences between these communities in Buenos Aires. We're not speaking about the same when we're speaking about the English, the Welsh, the Irish and the Scots. No? Is that true?
Yes, that's a correct appraisal. However, you must remember that anybody who was fair-haired and fairly clear-eyed was called an Inglés. As you just mentioned, Germans were Ingleses. Obviously, Scandinavians were Ingleses. Everybody were Ingleses, whether they liked it or not. The other thing is that history shows that in Argentina, the different English-speaking communities integrated quite well with one another, and that includes
better than they do back in the UK?
Yes, most probably. But this is out of necessity. The Scots had a tremendous row with the Anglican Church and in 1838 broke away and created their own church to the distress of the British consul in Buenos Aires. The Irish were always in their majority Catholic, but in language, in business, in sport, by necessity, they had to communicate and integrate with the other English-speaking. I suppose, really, the only really distant and isolated group were the Welsh, who chose to go to Chubut, far away from Buenos Aires. So therefore, they were not in immediate contact. And even then, they were in contact because the Welsh colony, the Welsh settlement on the River Chubut, subscribed to the British hospital and reserving a bed for any sick member of the Welsh community in Chubut. So, you can talk about regional and national differences always. They are there, and they are there from birth, and they are there from origin. But when they're all converging in a new country where the language is not their own, the behavior is different. I mean, you have to integrate and communicate with your neighbors, whether you politically want to or not.
Speaking of communicating and integrating, what about the religious factor? I suppose it is a very important chapter in this history. When did it evolve from intolerance towards non-Catholic religions to not considering someone who wasn't Catholic a pagan, as it was in colonial times?
Well, in theory, the abolition of differences and discrimination in Buenos Aires begins with 1813, when the Assembly declares the end of slavery, the end of discrimination, the end of religious differences. It intensifies with Rivadavia, president, who abolishes all monasteries. So you see that there is a process of change. Obviously, the Catholic establishment found it very difficult to integrate with the Anglican and even less with the Presbyterian communities. You have the situation where right into the late 1830s, the Catholic authorities in Buenos Aires were very angry with Governor Rosas for allowing the construction of that beautiful St. John's Cathedral on 25 de Mayo Street in the center of Buenos Aires, which is now a national monument, a historical site. But even, you must remember that even among themselves, the Irish wanted their own Catholic church, and they didn't want a church with the Porteños. They wanted a church where
Mass was given in English. It
was in Latin at that time, but they could speak in English among themselves, and they didn't want their daughters marrying into, shall we say, Catholic, Spanish.
Yeah.
Well, they called them Spanish at that time still. Spanish Catholic families. They wanted, they were very strict, the Irish community, about that. They wanted to keep their religion and keep their language and not assimilate. They were very strong.
Yeah, that's true for all English speaking communities. Why is that? Because other immigrant communities, most notably the Italian and the Spanish communities, they certainly integrated by. But the British really tried to remain isolated and pass their culture from one generation to the other without blending in.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one can be terribly crass and just say it's all a matter of money, because at the end of the day, it is that the immigration of English-speaking groups to Argentina really was of a mostly of a qualified working class upwards. So you had anything from teachers, qualified domestic servants upwards. And eventually you had railway employees who came with a craft or some training. And so on. You must remember that the numbers also were small. They were not. And when you have a small community, I mean, small numerically, they are probably far more preoccupied about keeping themselves to themselves and apart than when they're a very big community. Absolutely. And they can't control the lone wolves and the loose cannons that might be in their midst. The other thing one has to remember is if you look at the dates and the waves of immigration into Argentina, right up to the last wave of Italian immigration in the late 1940s and early 50s, they were of people desperately looking for work, employment of any kind. They were escaping starvation in many parts of Spain and probably Italy. They had come through Spain, civil war and isolation during the Second World War, Italy, a savage war of its own, first in, you know, abroad in Abyssinia, and then as an ally of the Axis. So you had these, shall we say, socially different people coming, and they didn't speak English. So the English-speaking community were very careful to keep themselves apart. I mean, the interesting, you can always find exceptions, but the interesting person here is the family of President Pellegrini, who was known as El Inglés Pellegrini, fancy with an Italian name like that. But he married the daughter of an English town planner, in fact, the planner of the city's waterworks. So you obviously have variations and differences wherever you look. But yes, the English speaking community, the Anglo Argentine community, was notorious for wanting to keep itself to itself.
We can't forget about sports, British sports in Argentina, that had a huge impact here, first among the British community, of course, and then among natives. And there is a particular case that interests me, which is polo, which a British sport in which Argentina became a world power.
Yes, it wasn't even a British sport. Let's remember India, that. It comes from, as the newspaper, The Standard, says, played in England and our Indian Empire. And that should sort of make the Indians laugh. But it starts in India. It's exported as a very elite pastime to England, and it comes here, where, of course, the horses were far more numerous, far better, and far more available.
Than in England.
Than in England, where it was, because of the weather, because everything because of the size of the country, whatever you want to call it. It is far more expensive to keep a horse. The poor man walked, he didn't ride, you know, sort of this sort of thing. And here everybody just grabbed a horse from somewhere and rode. So you also have the situation in other sports. Perhaps the only sport in which Argentines did not pursue was the first one to arrive, the first English sport to arrive in Buenos Aires, which was cricket. Cricket arrived with the British landing of 1806, and it never caught on here. But if you look at...
Why would that be? You know, all other sports caught on, rugby, polo, soccer, tennis.
Well, you could argue that all of the other sports are much faster. And the Criollo preferred a faster sport. Also, cricket is full of rules.
And the Criollo prefer not few, to abide by many.
Few rules. But you have... I mean, rugby came to Argentina in the late 1870s, sorry, and was banned for 10 years in Argentina because it was so brutal. I mean, the matches were not counted in tries and conversion. They were counted in injured, carried off the field. So the Buenos Aires government banned rugby, which was only practiced initially by the English-speaking community, by railway personnel. You must remember, rugby started in England in 1823, and then it begins to be exported to other parts of the world. So by 1870, when it gets going in Buenos Aires, it was a sport strictly for the English. Football is contemporary, 1867. You know, it arrives. The railways arrive. They build their club automatically. A very English practice. You arrive and you immediately.
So in that initial phase, the Criollo did not have interest at all in soccer. It was only strictly British matter.
It was a strictly English matter, in the sense that the English form of soccer, football, call it what you will, comes from a practice which is called crowd football. In other words, in England, any number of people took part and somebody had to get the ball. Transpose that to pre-Columbian times in South America, and you will find that Mayas, Aztecs, and Incas played similar sports with a stone wrapped in leather. Now, nobody wanted to catch that stone because if it hit you, you were out because you were knocked out. But the thing is that you had crowd football in England on fields and streets or whatever, especially on festivities and saints' days and public holidays of different kinds, not on Sundays, never on Sundays. So
because of religion.
So you had football practice there, but at first it was a curiosity. The Criollo had their own sports, which obviously included horse racing. A lot to do with horses,
like pato, for example.
Pato and all these various applications of equestrian practices, and in fact, the English sports that took place on the cricket field in Palermo were curiosities. People went from Buenos Aires by train to Palermo, which is just now one thinks of it just a few blocks away, but they went to watch the English beat each other up. So that's what they were doing. So, you know, there was great amusement. You know, these rather sort of strange gentlemen who lead companies in the city or towns or stores.
Beating each other up
on Saturdays, you know. And they come sort of off the field with a broken arm and a
bleeding
nose and all this sort of thing. Rugby matches, when they started, it did go on for 3 hours. And you know, they were 15 aside, but they go on for 3 hours. It caught on. Why does Argentina become such a force in rugby? Probably because eventually the fashion caught on and the following was great. Also, there is a time in Argentina, which is probably not so much the case now, where clubs were financially far more accessible than they were in England.
In which sense?
Well, you could join just any club and play rugby, and the membership did not cost you very much. It's changed now. I mean, in Britain, you have lots of available fields provided by the local government, so you can go and play.
But not in Victorian times.
Not in Victorian times. So you had a development. Polo, you had, as we said before, the availability of horses. Football grew out of English schoolmasters training Mr. Newell in Rosario, Mr. Watson Hutton at the English High School created alumni club, and so on. And people joined that. The earliest football matches among Argentines are in La Boca, with playing mixed teams with the crew from the ships that moored in the Boca port. So you had a very rapid spread of what is or was seen as a very entertaining form of spending the end of the week.
Now, speaking of the Rio de la Plata, let us talk about someone who sailed those waters and became maybe the most famous member for Argentines of the British community in Argentina, Admiral Guillermo Brown, or William Brown. Actually, he was an Irish, but we consider him a member of the British community. There are some fascinating stories about him.
He must have been a fascinating man, really. And there you are. In the matter of crossing over community boundaries, Brown had no problem in moving among the English community, especially, let's be very clear on this one, especially among the English ladies, whom he noted in his diary, you know, about their dress and about their arms, and you know, he made comment. So, but he was Irish, and he had that, what we would describe, that particular spark that the Irish always have, the inventiveness, the wit. And so he must have been a really remarkable individual. He escaped from capture in the war between the US and Britain, a very small little fight in 1812. He arrived here. He ran aground. He lost everything. He began again. He built up his own fleet by offering his services as seaman to the Buenos Aires government, and then promptly seized Spanish ships and called them his own. Now, he was a privateer.
But he didn't have military training when he started.
No, but he was obviously a very good seaman. So, you know, he was a very able seaman. He was a merchant, which is a thing you must see also, that to make a living, he goes back to his merchant life. He sort of ends a war, for instance. I don't know. He has a war of independence first, right, which is against Spain. Then in the 1820s, you have the war with Brazil. Then briefly, you have the Anglo-French blockade of the River Plate. And he is ordered by Rosas to resist that blockade. He's considered, and he considers himself a bit too old, and he retires.
And he doesn't. How old was he at the time?
Oh dear. Well, he was must have been very close to his 60s or beyond. So I can't remember immediately. But let's say that he was in his 60s, and he just felt he wasn't up to it anymore. But you know, the inventiveness of the man is seen by how he educated his crew in the early ships in the war against Spain.
Do you have any story?
The lovely one is that he knew that his sailors, who were really men on horseback, could play cards. And so the baraja española, the Spanish card. So he would give the ship the different names of the cards in the back. And so the people would, instead of talking about leeward and starboard and bow and stern, he would use the cards.
Sota.
Yes.
Copa.
Sota de basto, caballo de espada, whatever. And he'd train them that way. The other one, which just may be apocryphal, but it's so good you can't miss out. He ran out of ammunition in one conflict, was trapped, and he found a whole lot of very hard cheese in below decks somewhere. And it is said that he used the very hard cheese as ammunition to hit at his enemy. There are ways of saying that, because if it was hard cheese with a spark of gunpowder, it must have melted. So it must have splattered on the other side. Hot cheese is like scalding oil, you know. And it wouldn't have done any damage to anything in the hull of a ship. So really one can just question the validity of that article, but that story.
It's a lovely story.
But never mind, it's too good, we can't let it go by. The other thing is how he makes his first, builds his fleet in the war with Brazil, which is the war over the Banda Oriental, which later becomes Uruguay, is that he goes out with small craft and tempts the bigger ship into shallow waters. In the River Plate, and in shallow waters, he didn't need seamen. He could take men on horseback right up to the ship and attack the enemy crew. You know, these are things. And I love the stories also about, you know, he used to, in the middle of a conflict, he used to go and watch or sit in the theater when there was an English language play or a musical being shown in I don't know, some theater hall. But it must have been a substantial theater because he had his little box for his family. And there he was greeted. And it is said that no matter who was with him, he was always with his theater glasses, his binoculars or whatever. Well, they were theater glasses, looking at the ladies down in the stalls. There is tragedy, of course, in his life as well. And there's...
You're speaking about his daughter.
His daughter. And there's a stained window that remembers her and Lieutenant Drummond, who was her fiancé, who he is shot and killed during a battle against the Brazilian fleet. And he was engaged to Brown's daughter. And she, obviously in tremendous distress, puts on her bridal gown and walks into the River Plate and drowns. And there's quite an attractive stained glass window in St. John's Cathedral.
And with this interview that we bring you from our archives with the late journalist Andrew Graham Yule, we come to the end of this edition of Rai in English for Wednesday, March 4, 2026. My name is Fernando Farias, and this show aired on the shortwaves of WRMI, frequency 5850 kHz, and also via internet on rae.com.ar. Thank you very much for listening, folks, and hasta la próxima.